Les colloques du Collège de France.
So welcome back everybody. Philippe is now online, as you can see. So he will introduce his talk. Then we will play the video of a recorded talk. And then if Philippe is okay, we will do the Q&A with him online. Okay? So we are very glad to welcome him. So Philippe Goff, going to talk about conceivability argument against the existence of God. So Philippe, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's great to be able to talk here. Thanks to Julian and Gregory for inviting me and accommodating at the last minute my current situation. So just for those who don't know, 5 weeks ago, I suddenly lost consciousness whilst outside and fell and banged my head on a stone wall and concrete pavement and got a cracked skull and 2 brain bleeds. Fortunately, the good news is doctors say it's going to be a complete recovery, which is good because I kind of need my brain. I'm not quite there yet. I'm sort of quite low energy levels. So that's why I'm not there in person. So I thought it would be best. I found after an hour of conversation, I kind of run out of energy. So I thought it'd be best to make sure I've got full energy for the Q&A if we play this video of the talk I was hoping to give that I gave a couple of months ago at a conference for Barry Dainton's 65th birthday. And then I'll answer questions live afterwards. Just briefly on the content, I'm guessing perhaps not many people in this audience will be that into philosophy of religion, but I hope that there's a lot in here on transparency, the nature of transparency, the defense of transparency, and how that can be built into a project of rational rationalism. And I've come to think that actually reflecting on this topic of conceivability, possibility of God, has important implications for how we should develop that project. So I hope that's of some interest. Very finally, I promised Julian Gregory I'd develop it and say a little bit more on dual carving that Julian had an interesting talk on yesterday. I haven't had a chance to do that for these reasons. I don't explicitly mention dual carving, but I do briefly discuss the intuition that brute modal truths are... that there are no brute modal truths. And I think dual carving would be a case of that, such a brute modal truth. So just thought I'd say a bit about how that potentially fits in. Okay, but other than that, I'll sit here and watch the talk with you and look forward to your thoughts afterwards.
Thanks a lot. So we will now play your video and we will talk to you afterwards, okay?
Great.
Here. Okay, so this paper is trying to move into philosophy of religion a bit, but this is also very much rooted in one foot in philosophy of mind, these conceivability arguments that we find in the philosophy of mind literature. And part of what I'm doing here, as much as thinking about the question of whether God exists, is developing the project of linking conceivability to possibility. I think this brings up some interesting issues. When I first started thinking about this quite recently, this is a sort of brand new project, just did a talk in Reading last week, but that was the first time. I thought, oh, this has been done before, conceivability arguments against God, is there anything to add here? And lots of people I spoke to thought the same. But actually, I'd be happy if people could correct me, but when I started looking into the literature, it seems like it has hardly been done, actually. The last time, as far as I can make out, it was such an argument was defended in a paper. It was in 1948, in Mind. And, looking back at that, so we can critique, you know, analytic philosophy's got too technical. I've sort of just done that. But looking back at that article, it seems like that's maybe a period of philosophy. It wasn't technical enough. It was sort of not entirely rigorous. And another person who's done it sort of... It's quite sketchily A.C. Grayling, but in a very sort of not fully fleshed out form. So I think there is real scope for developing this quite interesting argument. What was the other thing I was going to say about it? I can't remember. Okay. Oh yeah. So that's one reason to explore this. But there's going to be also a little bit of a twist in the way I'm doing this. The paper has a kind of Hegelian structure, inspired by David Chalmers' Hegelian argument for panpsychism. So this is not at all supposed to be proper Hegel scholarship. I'm not an expert in Hegel, unlike my colleague Jeremy Dunham. Just the idea is the structure resembles the way we think of Hegel with the dialectic, that you have the thesis of an argument for a certain position, and then the... Do you say antithesis or antithesis in the context of Hegel? Don't know. Anyway, what?
Antithesis.
Antithesis. I know that's the word, but I didn't know whether...
Antithesis.
Yeah. Okay, so you have the antithesis arguing for the converse conclusion, and then you have a synthesis to resolve the tension. So I'm going to present a conceivability argument for atheism, and then I'm going to present a conceivability argument for theism, and we've got a stressful tension, and then the synthesis is going to be a conceivability argument against a conscious God, and we'll see how that could be different from other conceptions of God. Okay, so here's the conceivability argument. It's quite warm in here. Conceivability argument for atheism. It's conceivable that there is no consciousness. If it's conceivable that there's no consciousness, then it's possible that there's no consciousness. Therefore, it's possible there's no consciousness. If God exists, then God is necessarily conscious and necessarily existent. Therefore, God does not exist. So in terms of the validity of the second inference there, I'm sure there's some techie modal logic stuff I'm assuming here. I mean, I think you get the idea that, well, if God exists in all possible worlds and is necessarily conscious, then that's incompatible with a possible world where there's no consciousness. If someone could just fill me in on the modal logic assumptions I need to be making there, so I could just put it in and move on, that would be great. Anyway, I'm going to assume that is a valid inference. All right, you think the record... I think I'm all right with the mic. Pick that up. Okay, so let's start to think about the premises. So, conceivability. So one interesting thing that's come up here, thinking about this... I've talked a lot about and written a lot about conceivability arguments. I've always just worked with what David Chalmers calls negative conceivability, which is just what can't be ruled out a priori. You know, square circles can be ruled out a priori, flying pigs can't. Because it's it's nice, easy to define, and I didn't see the need for anything different. But actually, we'll get to this later, this topic has made me think actually we need to talk about positive conceivability. So I look back at my David Chalmers, how he defines positive conceivability, and this is roughly how he does it. So I'm just starting to think about positive conceivability, really. So if you have any thoughts about difficulties with this conception of it. So crucially, positive conceivability has what he calls building on work from Yablo, a mediated objectual character that goes beyond merely entertaining a proposition. In conceiving, one imagines a situation in which the proposition is true. So perhaps the clearest example is thinking about sensory imagination. I'm imagining a fire-breathing dragon, and a dragon breathing fire on the earth, and then I recognize that as a scenario in which it is true that there is a dragon breathing on the earth. So there's a relation between three things, really. It's not just me, my mind, and a proposition, as in when you're entertaining a proposition that, you know, dragons are breathing fire on the earth. But there's also an imagined situation, a sort of arrangement of objects and properties, and then you recognize that or acknowledge that as a situation in which the proposition is true. So that's an example with sensory imagination, but it's not, conceivability is not supposed to be tied to sensory imagination. It seems we can conceive of things that we can't imagine sensorially, in infinity perhaps, or four-dimensional objects, or subatomic particles. Now, there can be all sorts of rough and ready conceivings of things. So crucially, we have this third component, that in positive conceivability, it is possible to fill in arbitrary details in the imagined scenario or situation such that no contradiction reveals itself. And what we're ultimately interested in is what Chalmers calls ideal conceivability, where a proposition can be conceived of in such a way that no possible filling in of arbitrary details would reveal a contradiction. Okay, that's positive conceivability. So premise one, it's conceivable that there is no consciousness. Well, it's interesting that in the standard zombie arguments against physicalism, I think this premise is entailed by the first premise of those arguments, because a zombie world is typically defined as a minimal physical duplicate of the physical world in which there is no consciousness. It's not like there's no consciousness in brains, or it's just there's no consciousness. It's supposed to be a world of no consciousness. So I think that is a world in which there is no consciousness. So I think if you accept the conceivability claim in the standard zombie argument, you ought to accept the conceivability claim of this argument for atheism. For what it's worth, 60% of philosophers think zombies are conceivable. That's on the Phil Papers 2020 survey, adding together those who think, the anti-physicalists who think they're possible, and the vast majority of physicalists, like Laura here, being an exemplar, who thinks they're conceivable but not possible, right? Anyway, it's not a popularity contest. I know Richard thinks the bollocks, which we... but, you know, at least if 60% of people, you know, it's rare to have consensus, at least give you pause for thought, perhaps. But anyway, one thing I'm really interested here is, if you accept the conceivability argument against physicalism, you should accept what I'm going to get to, the first two premises of the conceivability argument against God. So that's kind of, I hope, of dialectical significance, because I think there are plenty of theists who argue against physicalism with conceivability arguments. Maybe a bit problematic if those arguments rebound against their own view. People have pressed this against panpsychism, actually. The conceivability argument seems to go against them, but maybe something similar happens to theists. I know I said I wouldn't do this, but 12:30 we go to, isn't it? The whole session, yeah. Okay, so that's premise. That's as much as I'll say about premise one. So let's start to look at premise two now. Okay, so firstly, we need to bring in some modal rationalism. This is the project of linking conceivability to possibility. You could imagine a very simple modal rationalism. For any proposition P, P is conceivably true, just in case P is possibly true. I don't think many people accept that, because people are largely persuaded by these kind of Kripke and counterexamples. Here's one I like to give that isn't quite from Kripke, but similar thought. It's conceivable but not possible that water is a fundamental element. The ancient Greeks used to think that. Seems conceivable. But if you think water is, well, we now know water is essentially H2O, it's essentially composite, it's impossible for it to be a simple element. So we need a more nuanced connection between conceivability and possibility. A couple of options, maybe more. David Chalmers, two-dimensional semantic framework. I worry about his framework. I'm not going to get into this now, but that it has certain semantic presuppositions that Chalmers has never adequately defended. I was really happy in my PhD that I realised something I disagreed with David Chalmers on, so I had something interesting to say. An alternative approach is that myself and Martina Niederrumelen have defended in different places, which I call now essentialist modal rationalism. Another benefit of it is I think it's a bit easier to explain than Chalmers' two-dimensional semantic framework. So here's me kissing Chalmers at a conference in Rio in 2014. Anyway, that's not part of the argument. It's just, I got a bigger laugh for that than I did at Reading. Actually, I was on Zoom, so I probably couldn't hear. Anyway, starting to ramble. Right, so this, what is this essentialist modal rationalism? Well, I'm going to tell you, it's a picture of Martine here, but I'll just say how I to define it, but she has a similar project. I think she's speaking at CEU there. Okay, so this is, we distinguish, the crucial part of this idea is we distinguish between two kinds of concept, transparent concepts and opaque concepts. So a transparent concept is a concept referring to an entity... A concept C referring to entity is transparent just in case C reveals the nature of E. That is, what it is for E to be part of reality is a priori accessible for someone possessing C in virtue of possessing C. So transparent concepts are supposed to reveal the nature of their reference. So sphericity may be an example. If you possess the concept of sphericity, you can know a priori that for something to be spherical is for all points on the surface to be equally distant from the centre. That's what it is to be a sphere. Party, maybe we know a priori what it is for there to be a party. Hard to articulate in necessary sufficient conditions. I don't think that's entailed by the having a transparent concept. We could maybe talk about that. But anyway, that's the idea. Whereas opaque concepts reveal little or nothing about the nature of E. For example, water, lightning. You can't know that lightning is essentially electric discharge just by reasoning. You have to do some science. And there are all sorts of in-between categories I've explored, but might not be so relevant here. So what's the idea of essentialist modal rationalism? Is that we explain the gap between conceivability and possibility that people like Kripke and Putnam opened up by saying, well, it's because the gap opens up when we don't understand the essence of what we're conceiving of. So it's conceivable but not possible that water is a fundamental element, because water is a... It should be not a transparent concept. Crucial missing not there. Because water isn't a transparent concept, when you're thinking of water, conceiving of... You don't know what you're conceiving of. You don't know what the metaphysical reality of what you're conceiving of. So that's why the gap opens up. Whereas the thought is, if you're just dealing with transparent concepts, you have a sort of perfect metaphysical understanding of what you're conceiving of, then you no longer have a gap between conceivability and possibility. So here's a first attempt at it, which we're going to qualify essentialist modal rationalism. For any proposition P, P is possibly true just in case P is conceivably true, and P contains only transparent concepts. But there's a problem with that, which I explored in 2019 paper Essentialist Modal Rationalism, so I'm just sort of repeating what I said there. But I would be interested if you think it's wrong. There's a worry about what I call a brute one-offs. That is to say, entities which are not uniquely picked out by their essences. So if you think about electrons have the essential nature of, I don't know, a certain amount of negative charge, certain amount of mass. But the essence of an electron is the same for every other electron, right? And yet we might think electrons are distinct individuals. So if we have Bob and Bill, names for different electrons, well, the proposition Bob the electron is identical with Bill the electron will end up being conceivably true but not possibly true, right? You can't know just through reflecting on that proposition. For all you know, it could be that they are the same electron, but as a matter of fact, these terms refer to distinct electrons, and so it's impossible for them to be one and the same thing. So how I get round this is just by building in facts, the relevant facts about which things are or are not identical. And that might sort of seem like cheating, but I don't think it is, because I think, you know, the idea of essentialist modal rationalism is you've got to be able to understand what you're conceiving of, the sort of metaphysical goings-on of what you're conceiving of. And in these cases where you have brute one-offs, all there is to be understood is that some things are brutally identical with some things or brutally distinct from other things. So there's no way of sort of understanding that other than just bringing in the facts of identity. Okay, so here's the qualified definition of essentialist modal rationalism. Proposition P is possibly true just in case P is conceivably true. P contains only transparent concepts, and insofar as P contains concepts referring to brute one-offs, B1, B2 to Bn, P star is conceivably true. Well, this is a new proposition, where P star is the proposition formed from joining P with true information concerning all identities and non-identities between the entities involved in B1 to B2, etc. So the idea here is just when you completely understand the essence of everything you're thinking of, and you know which things are identical and non-identical to which, then conceivability entails possibility. All right, that's immodal rationalism. Why accept that? Well, I think it offers a plausible diagnosis of the Kripke cases, of why there is this gap between conceivability and possibility. Offers an account of the epistemology of modality. How the hell do we know? What's metaphysically possible? Well, it's what's conceivable. And also, perhaps could be motivated by just a basic intuition against brute modal facts. The idea that, let's say, a million-sided object might be just conceivable but not possible. So, you know, that, like, even God reflects in all ways on the idea of a million-sided object, can find no contradiction or incoherence. God tries to create it, thinks, oh, gosh, it must be just brutally impossible. I mean, that just seems really weird in the way, you know, it's one thing to find brute contingent facts weird, like the universe existing without a reason. It seems to me even weirder to find brute necessities. But obviously, if you don't share that intuition, then that might not do much work. But again, we've got this parity claim, right? If you accept the conceivability argument in physicalism, I think you're going to buy into something like this, which would lead to the first two premises of the conceivability argument. Maybe you'll do it in David Chalmers' way rather than mine. Okay, so that doesn't quite get us premise two. Basically, modal rationalism roughly says, if you're just dealing with transparent concepts, conceivability entails possibility. So now we need to ask, well, are the relevant concepts transparent concepts, that these essence-revealing concepts? So we're conceiving of there being no consciousness, where you've got a sort of existential quantifier, a negation sign, and you've got the concept of consciousness. Okay, so is consciousness, the concept of consciousness or consciousness concepts, transparent? So this comes to the thesis come to be known as revelation, nothing to do with the book of Revelation, but I googled revelation and got that picture. So this is the thesis roughly that phenomenal concepts are transparent. So phenomenal concepts is the technical term for our paradigm experiential concepts. So when you think about your experience in terms of what it's like or how it feels, you're in pain, you think about your pain in terms of how it feels, you thereby form a phenomenal concept of your pain. Okay, so the idea would be when you form a phenomenal concept, that reveals the essence, what it is for you to have pain. In something like the way sphericity reveals the essence, the concept of sphericity reveals the essence of sphericity, the concept of your pain reveals the essential nature of your pain. Well, that's a little bit too crude, just to put it like that. One issue is phenomenal concepts can be very rough and ready, not always accurate. You know, you might just think, oh, I've got that pain again. Got this very rough and ready concept that might leave out a lot of the nuanced character of the experience you're denoting. Or maybe you can get things a bit wrong, you know. You think you're experiencing orange and you're experiencing red or something. Chalmers tries to get around this by talking about direct phenomenal concepts. Phenomenal concepts whose content is based entirely on attention to experience. So you just think about your experience and you think, I'm feeling like that. And you don't impose any prior categorization on it. I used to go along with that, but I've been having doubts recently, and there's a book coming out comparing my panpsychism in analytic philosophy with that of Graham Harman in the continental tradition, and writing for that I was having doubts about direct phenomenal concepts, partly based on meditation, right? I think if you meditate on the breath for a long time, you know, at first you feel like you're just attending to the experience of the breath. But after a couple of hours, say, I think it becomes apparent that actually you're sort of imposing an idea of the breath in a very subtle way on the breath experience. You're not quite just experiencing what's there to be experienced. You're imposing a sort of caricature of of the experience of breathing. And I wonder whether we, any of us, really do can really have just these direct phenomenal concepts. Maybe you can get closer to it in meditation, but maybe you're always sort of subtly imposing stuff. So what I say now, and this is what I'm calling here refined revelation, is just to say a phenomenal concept is transparent insofar as it accurately captures what it is like to have its referent, what it's like to have the corresponding experience. You might think at first, isn't that just trivial? But no, it's not, because lots of physicalists disagree with this. I think Laura disagrees with it, she can say for herself. But anyway, lots of physicalists explicitly, David Papineau, Brian McLaughlin, think, you know, when I think about my experiences, like I'm thinking about my pain in terms of how it feels, I don't know anything about its metaphysical nature, right? Turns out to be a brain state I'm thinking about. I don't know anything about that. I just don't know anything about its nature. I'm just sort of pointing at something. Okay, so revelation disagrees though. It says, no, insofar as you're understanding how the experience feels, to that degree you're grasping its essence. That's what the experience essentially consists in, a way of feeling. Why accept that? I think it's self-evident. Again, not very persuasive if you think about it. I don't think it is, but for those who haven't thought about this, don't have a committed position, I find it can be persuasive. Well, I think at least part of it's self-evident. I think what seems to me pretty self-evident is when I think about my experience in terms of what it's like, there is at least some property I understand the essence of. And to see whether you agree with me on that, again, just contrast the sort of Papineau and McLaughlin position. So when you think, for them, when you're thinking about how your pain feels, you're just sort of pointing inside yourself, right? This thing, I know not what, turns out to be a brain state. I mean, that just seems to me, this is not an argument, it's an appeal to intuition, that just seems to me self-evidently wrong. I have a rich, positive, when I'm thinking about how the pain feels or the quality of a red experience, that is a rich understanding of some property at least. Okay, now you might agree with that, you might say, well, okay, it's a rich understanding of some, the essence of some property, but does it mean it's the essence of the whole experience? So this then gets to a sort of partial revelation thesis, which lots of people on my side as well sign up to. But I find when people often express support for partial revelation, they rarely sort of fill in the details. So if someone says to me, partial revelation, that we grasp part of the essence of our experiences, it seems to me, well, then you must have sort of two sub-concepts here with two kinds of reference fixing going on. One of which is affording a sort of a grasp of the essence, one of which is denoting aspects of the experience in some other way that doesn't reveal the essence. Tell me about the kinds of reference fixing and how do they fit together in a single unified concept? I find you never get satisfactory details. Anyway, I talk about this a lot in my book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. Okay, so that's one way of defending this. Well, I've also argued, given some inference to the best explanation arguments. I'm gonna speed up so we have plenty of time for discussion. But again, I'm trying to do this. A large part of what I'm trying to do is, if a theist, well, I'll just read this out. So I think theists are unlikely to think like Laura-style physicalists that conscious states have hidden physical or functional essences, as it would then be impossible for God to be conscious. So again, it's a sort of dialectical significance if theists are, you know, I'm trying to get premises that theists will be committed to or are likely to be committed to. Okay, so then we have premise two. So the proposition there is no consciousness contains only experiential. What should that be? There's an and. Take out the and there. That's a mistake. Only experiential concepts, essentialist modal rationalism, revelation. These together imply that if it's conceivable that there's no consciousness, then it's possible that there's no consciousness, right? Because essentialist modal rationalism says, well, if we're just dealing with transparent concepts, conceivability entails possibility, and the revelation claim essentially says, well, we are just dealing with transparent concepts. Okay, so that's our argument for atheism. Hooray, we prove God doesn't exist. The problem is, here's the twist. So that was all, it gets a bit less technical now. If you've been daydreaming for the whole of that, technical discussion of modal rationalism. It's about to get a bit more interesting, so come back. Not that much more interesting, but a bit more interesting. Okay, so, problem is, there seems to be a conceivability argument for theism, connected to modal ontological argument associated with Alvin Plantinga. I'm not going to get into all the details, but the basic idea is that God is a necessary being, and as such, God can't contingently exist. Either God exists in all possible worlds, or in none. And then the thought is, well, God seems possible at least. So God exists in one, at least one possible world, but he must exist in all possible worlds, and hence the actual world. Oh, it's interesting actually, talking to Yuji Nagasawa about this. I've assumed actually that people did defend the possibility claim there with conceivability considerations. But actually, Eugen said he was the first person to do that in his Maximal God book, which is kind of surprising. But anyway, so we could, following Eugen, back up that conceivability premise. Sorry, that possibility premise with the conceivability argument. So here's our conceivability argument for theism. If it's conceivable that God exists, If it's conceivable that God exists, then it's possible that God exists. It's possible that God exists. If it's possible that God exists, then it's necessary that God exists. If it's necessary that God exists, then it's actual that God exists. So it's actual that God exists. Okay. What do I think about this? Well, what about the conceivability claim, right? Is it conceivable? Is it conceivable that God exists? As I say, this hasn't been as much discussed as you might think in the academic literature. Jack Symes pointed out to me that William Lane Craig, pictured here, working in his vest, thought was a motivation for all of us. He says in his podcast, the other person who's talked about, A.C. Grayling, I did, yeah. So he responds to Grayling on his podcast and says, well, look, Grayling is wrong because God is negatively conceivable. He doesn't use that term, but he says, look, the concept is coherent. So I think Craig is right. And so this is why, I think Craig is right that God is negatively conceivable. There's nothing a priori we can rule out God's existence. But is God positively conceivable? And this is why I think, now I need to talk about positive conceivability. Is God positively conceivable? Well, on modal rationalism, a necessary being is one whose non-existence we can rule out a priori. Right, that has to be true, otherwise you'd have something that's conceivable but not possible, namely God not existing, or the necessary being not existing. Okay, in other words, for a modal rationalist, a necessary being has to have what I'm going to call an existence-guaranteeing essence. That is to say, an essence of a concrete entity, such that if you grasp that essence, you'd be able to rule out a priori its non-instantiation. So you can perhaps make this clear in terms of its polar opposite, an existence-negating essence, such as being a square circle. Right? Think of the essence of being a square circle. Just through reflecting on that, you can see that can't exist. Right? There can't be such a thing. An existence-guaranteeing essence would be an essence where you think about it and you just say, oh my God, that has to exist. That has to be instantiated in a concrete being. I want to say we can't positively conceive of such an essence. Everything we can conceive of is conceivably non-existent. Insofar as we think of God as all-knowing, an all-knowing, all-powerful, perfectly good being, I think that's conceivably non-existent. Now, it's also part of the definition of God that God exists necessarily, perhaps because God is perfect. But even then, that gets us that either God exists in all possible worlds or in none. But that still doesn't guarantee God's existence. So our whole conception of God, insofar as we can positively conceive of God, it doesn't involve an existence guaranteeing it. It's God is still conceivably non-existent. So I want to say anything we can conceive of is we can conceive of existence negating essences, but we can't positively conceive of existence guaranteeing essences. Everything we can positively conceive of is conceivably non-existent. So where does this leave us? So I think we cannot positively conceive of an existence guaranteeing essence, but we cannot rule out that there is some possible being that can positively conceive of an existence guaranteeing essence. Maybe because it has one and it can reflect on it. Or maybe because it can just imagine one. On the other hand, nor can we establish that there is some possible being that can positively conceive of an existence guaranteeing essence. So therefore, I think we should say we just don't know whether or not an existence guaranteeing essence is positively conceivable, and therefore don't know whether or not a necessary being is possible. So, you know, there are two epistemic possibilities here. It could be that there is a possible being that can conceive of an existence guaranteeing essence, and then that possible being could know a priori that that thing exists, and therefore that thing must exist in all possible worlds. Or it could be that there is no possible being that can positively conceive of an existence guaranteeing essence, and therefore there is no there is not even possibly such a being whose essence guarantees its existence. So I just think the modal rationalist should say both of these possibilities are open. We just don't know whether or not there is a necessary being. Okay, but we still have a dialectical tension. So we've somewhat weakened the conceivability argument for God. We didn't get I don't think it's successful. I mean, just to make that clear, maybe this has gone over it quite quickly. I want to say we don't know. Premise one of the argument, I would say we just don't know whether or not it's conceivable. We can't positively conceive of God, of a necessary being, but we don't know whether some other possible beings could. But still, we've got a dialectical tension, right? Because the argument for atheism showed that God does not exist, whereas the above reasoning, our argument, the above reasoning showed that God might exist. So we've still got a tension, right? We need a synthesis to resolve our painful tension. Okay, so final thing. I think I'll probably just go till about 5 past, I think, because we started 5 minutes late. So here's a little way to resolve the tension, and this is developing, I think, the modal rationalist project. So I want to introduce you to a concept of the intrinsic modal status, right? So For any state of affairs S, the intrinsic modal status of S is the modal status it has in virtue of S itself, considered in isolation. Now, if there are no necessary beings, intrinsic modal status and modal status per se probably won't come apart. But if there are necessary beings, I think these two things might come apart. This is also something that's sort of emerged in my thinking, partly thinking about work of Jack Symes that we've been discussing. Anyway, let me give you a concrete example to try and make that clear. So let's think about gratuitous evil, defined roughly as bad stuff that has no justifying reason, that not even God would have a reason to bring about. We can imagine, you know, the possible world where every created being suffers terribly forever, right? That's just a world that is so horrible there couldn't possibly be any justifying reason, like any greater good for the sake of which that state of affairs is created. Now, of course, it's controversial whether there is gratuitous evil. I think there is gratuitous evil, and therefore God doesn't exist in one conception of God. But of course, theists will say, no, there isn't. Maybe there seems to be gratuitous evil, but we can offer a theodicy, or we can say God has a reason even if we don't know it. Okay, so let's just, for the sake of discussion, say the theist is right about that. But still, we can talk about scenarios we could all agree would be gratuitous evil. Now, okay, so what is the modal status of gratuitous evil? On the one hand, it's conceivable. We can positively conceive of a world where every created being suffers forever. And so as a modal rationalist, you might say, Well, it's possible. On the other hand, let's pretend for the sake of discussion God exists. And God would never create gratuitous evil. So it's impossible, because God's never going to create it, and God's in all possible worlds. So there's a sort of tension here. I suggest we resolve this by saying that gratuitous evil is intrinsically contingent, but if God exists, it's necessarily non-existent. So it's contingently existent, like considered in and of itself, gratuitous evil is could exist and could not exist. But then if God exists and is necessary, then it's impossible. So you see, we get a distinction between the intrinsic modal status of something and its modal status per se. Modality is to do with possibility, necessity, contingency, if people aren't familiar with that jargon. Maybe should have said that earlier. So I suggest this leads us to a further refinement of modal rationalism. I'm proposing that we think of the above theory of modal rationalism I outlined earlier as an account not of modal status, but of intrinsic modal status. Right, so we say for any proposition P, the state of affairs expressed by P is intrinsically possible, just in case P is conceivably true and all those other conditions we discussed are met. Okay, well, this then leads to the rejection of our initial argument for atheism, I think. Just looking at the first part of that argument, well, all we can now claim is that it's intrinsically possible that there's no consciousness, considering that state of affairs just in itself. If it's conceivable, then it's intrinsically possible, therefore we conclude it's intrinsically possible that there's no consciousness. But the theist could say, well, could point out that the intrinsic possibility of there being no consciousness is compatible with God having an existence guaranteeing essence that guarantees God's consciousness. So it might be intrinsically contingent, but actually impossible. Just like gratuitous evil is contingent. Sorry. I think I said the wrong thing there. It might be intrinsically contingent, but actually but impossible. Just like gratuitous evil is intrinsically contingent, but actually impossible if God exists. Okay, so we reject our argument for atheism. However, I think there's another argument, and this is the argument I actually want to support, left available to us as follows. It's conceivable both that there is consciousness and that there isn't consciousness. Premise two, if that's the case, then the state of affairs of there being consciousness is intrinsically contingent, considered just in and of itself. Premise three, if the state of affairs of there being consciousness is intrinsically contingent, then God is necessarily conscious only if God has some non-experiential properties of God that necessitate that God is conscious. So remember, so if it's intrinsically intrinsically contingent in and of itself, well, if God is necessarily conscious, it must be because God has other, more fundamental properties that guarantee her consciousness. Therefore, we can conclude that being conscious is not part of God's fundamental nature. And so I want to say this is still inconsistent with a pretty standard understanding of God, where God is, in God's fundamental nature, all-knowing, all-powerful, perfectly good, and these are understood as mental concepts involving consciousness. This is ruling that out. And indeed, I think on this kind of view, we might think of it as, in a sense, God's first act of creation, making herself conscious. Not that there's a particular time at which that happened, it's sort of going to be true from eternity. So God is going to be necessarily conscious, but still there's a dependence relation between God's consciousness and more fundamental aspects of God's nature. So I still want to say that's ruling out a fairly standard understanding of God. Okay, picture of me and Richard Swinburne at a recent event. I'd like to get a selfie with Barry before this event finishes. Anyway, Okay, but what? What kind of God does this or doesn't it rule out? There are various different conceptions of God. I think in the public mind, you know, God is this kind of mental conception of God as a conscious being. That view is what Brian Davies calls theistic personalism, associated with many, perhaps the majority of contemporary analytic philosophers who are theists, Richard Swinburne, Alvin Plantinga, according to which God is a person, God is a kind of mind, a mind without limitations. But that's not... It's arguable. Some people think that's a sort of very modern development. We also have the classical theist tradition, going back to Augustine and Aquinas, on which God is radically unlike created beings, transcending all forms of composition and complexity. So God isn't, strictly speaking, phenomenally conscious. That would be to make God too similar to creation. And God doesn't have numerous mental properties. That would undermine divine simplicity, although I don't know how that might connect with Howard's talk. We also have, we've always had in all the apophatic, in all the Abrahamic faiths, the apophatic tradition where God, nothing positive can be said about God. So Origen, Gregory of Nyssa, going back that God is, in God's positive nature, God is beyond understanding. So I think what I'm arguing against here is theistic personalism. The idea that God is, in God's fundamental nature, is a conscious mind. I'm definitely not arguing against apophatic theology. So what I'm arguing really is everything we can conceive of, including consciousness, is possibly non-existent, or intrinsically possibly non-existent. So that rules out God on the theistic personalist conception, but it doesn't rule out that God has some totally unknown nature that somehow guarantees God's existence, that is somehow not even conceivably non-existent. So God, on this apophatic, we might have this existence-guaranteeing nature that we have no positive conception of, but maybe in the life to come, you say, oh my God, God has to exist once you grasp God's nature. Now, I'm not sure whether or not I'm ruling out classical theism. It would depend, I get confused with classical theism, it would depend whether the classical theists are saying we do have some positive understanding of God. If we can positively conceive of God, then I'm arguing against them as well. But if they don't say that, then I'm not arguing against them. Aquinas has his doctrine of analogy, that can be interpreted in different ways. Anyway, just a couple more minutes. So this is my substantive conclusion, really. But finally, very, very finally, let me just connect this to... sorry, a little question at the end. But just, you know, this has been a little bit technical in parts. The big questions of philosophy. Why does the universe exist? Why is there something rather than nothing? This is a question I think it would be at least nice to have an answer to. And I guess essentially my problem with theistic personalism... So if you've drifted off the whole time, this is the really interesting bit. Come back now. My problem with theistic personalism is just positing a sort of super mind doesn't seem to me to provide a satisfying answer to that question. So we then have the natural question, well, why does that super mind exist? You know, it's the go-to objection of the teenage new atheist, but I think there's something to it. You know, Richard Swinburne tries to say, well, God is simpler than other brute facts, and I think he makes a persuasive case for that, but still, you're still stuck with a brute fact. It doesn't scratch the itch, it maybe just makes it a bit less itchy. So it seems to me the only way there could be a satisfying answer to the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is if there is an existence-guaranteeing essence. And that's the God I'm yearning for. You say, oh my God, I see why you have to exist. It puts an end to Cartesian doubt. So that's the only way there could really be a satisfying answer to that. However, nothing we can conceive of is like that. Everything we can conceive of is possibly non-existence. So, if there is a God who can provide a satisfying answer to why we exist, maybe not one we could understand, or we'll only understand in the life to come, but if there is such a God who can in principle provide that, that God must be beyond human understanding. That's essentially the point I'm trying to make. Thank you. Like to see what you think. Hear what you think.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.